Welcome to Libertarians Working for You with host Arvind Vohra. Our program explains how to solve the most critical problems we face in America today: unemployment, debt, healthcare affordability, high taxes, loss of personal freedoms, loss of privacy, threats of war, and more. Now, here is your host, Arvind Vohra.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vohra. One of the most common misconceptions about libertarian policies is that they only help the ultra-rich. Now, on one side, that just doesn't really make any sense. Many of the ultra-rich are only ultra-rich because they are good at manipulating government to their benefit. But there's more to it than that, and we're going to talk about some of that today with my first guest. Father Larry Bean is a Louisiana libertarian and a teacher at the Wittenberg Academy. He's also a pastor at the Salem Lutheran Church in Gretna, Louisiana. He's an active member of the College of Libertarians at Loyola University. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Arvind. It's great to be here.
Now, what are some of the ways that libertarian policies would benefit the poor?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's good to kind of take stock of the world and our 20th century history, just kind of the lay of the land on this, because I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about the effect of economic liberty on poverty. Like, what I mean by that is this: right now, would you rather live in North Korea or South Korea? Would you rather be a poor person in North Korea or a poor person in South Korea? In the days of communism in Europe and Russia, you know, would you rather be in the United States or the USSR or, you know, really East Germany or West Germany? And we've seen this again and again and again, where under systems that guarantee, you know, a living wage or guarantee full employment, that have a lot of programs for, you know, to alleviate poverty, there's an unintended consequence at work, and they actually create poverty and misery and bring everything to a grinding halt. So, you know, I think that it's pretty much a no-brainer to say where we see an increase in freedom and an increase in economic liberty, we see a decrease in poverty. So I think first that ought to be kind of a thing that gets our attention before we even look at individual policies and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting point. I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it, that the countries that are very statist, the ones whose entire reason for existence is the raising up of the poor or the proletariat or however you want to look at it, are the countries in which it's the worst place to be poor.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's an unintended consequence. Even let's just put best construction on it and say that there, you know, people really want to alleviate poverty, and so they enact government programs to do it. But, you know, is that the best institution to accomplish a goal? I mean, you know, we all make jokes about the DMV. I don't know if you remember, back when I was a kid, there was a comedian, Lily Tomlin, who did this character where she played an obnoxious phone operator, and she would just like hang up on people, and she was really nasty to people. And she'd say, "I don't have to care because I work for the phone company." Well, back in those days, the phone company had a government monopoly. Well, you know, if your cell company treated you really poorly today, it's real easy to change companies. And so, you know, the problem with government is that it's a monopoly, and in a monopoly, there's no incentive to innovate, to change, to learn from mistakes. There's only an incentive to keep the whole thing going. And if people get hurt in the process or things don't work, well, that's okay. So, you know, really, the last institution in the world we should entrust to helping the least fortunate in society ought to be the state. I mean, basically the state is pretty good at one thing, and that's really killing people, not really helping people.
Mm-hmm. So, what about the flip side? What are some of the things that would benefit the poor in, you know, countries that are less statist than North Korea, but still have a very statist influence, for example, our own?
Well, to get out of poverty, what you really need is opportunity. You need a job. And in order to get a job, you need you know, firms that are willing to hire you, which it's based on voluntary economic activity. You know, if there's a company down the road that needs some entry level people, and there are some people living in poverty that, hey, you know, I don't have a job at all right now, but, and pushing a broom would be an improvement to my situation, then you provide those entry level jobs to do that. But in the name of eliminating poverty, what do? We establish a minimum wage, which sounds very humane, but all it does is it eliminates all those jobs that might be entry level that might actually it might actually pay for a company to hire someone to sweep the floor. But if it costs more to sweep a floor than someone can, then they can hire a person to do it. Maybe they'll look into technology and get a robot to do it, or maybe they'll just hire one person where they would have normally hired five. And and you let that kind of percolate throughout the whole economy, and it creates unemployment. It creates the inability to sort of grab hold of the first rung on the ladder. And that's essentially where you get out of poverty, by grabbing hold of the ladder. And you're not going to stay there forever. If you work hard and you learn, you know, people do advance in their jobs. But if you never get started in the first place, you're mired in poverty. And sometimes these government programs and interventions tend to create disincentive to grab hold of the rung and work your way up.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for instance, let's just say that there's a hypothetical country where everybody in the country gets a check for $30,000 a year, no matter what. You just get that. That's a living wage. That's your starting, you know. So you can just sit around and watch TV all day long and make 30 grand. Well, let's say there's an opportunity. You can become an auto mechanic, and it pays 35 grand, an entry-level auto mechanic job. Well, why in the world would you take that job? You know, you have a disincentive, because on the margin, you're only going to get 5 grand for all that work for 40 hours a week. I mean, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
So what it does is it creates an artificial lack of incentive to go the next step. And the secondary problem is, if everybody's getting a check for $30,000, that's got to get paid from someplace. So you're taxing people who are productive, who are working, who are hiring people. You're taxing them and taking money out of their ability to do research and development or to hire people. You know, it's an unseen cost that nobody really considers, and it's double whammy on the economy. And who pays for that? Who hurts the most? It's not going to be the millionaire that's making a half a million instead of a full million. It's going to be the people at the very bottom who go nowhere, whose children don't have any incentive to learn or to grow or to work. It creates just kind of sloth and a disconnect from how does an economy work? How does food get to the table? If people are just getting money and, you know, checks, and just because by virtue of they're human beings and that people feel sorry for them, they're really just kind of cut out of the whole economic process.
Now, what do you say when someone says, then what about what happens to the poor? What happens to the people who maybe they can't work because they're disabled in some way? What happens to them in this free market?
Well, again, you know, the assumption is that government has to take care of them. But if people, think about it, if you went from paying roughly 40 or 50% of your income in taxes in one way or the other, at different levels of government and so forth, if you had that much more money on you, you would be in a much better position to donate more money to your church or to donate more money to various aid agencies. You could help people a lot more. I mean, that's the way it used to work. People used to take care of their relatives, people in their community. In the sort of supposedly bad old days of the robber barons, these extremely wealthy people, what were they doing? They were founding hospitals. They were starting universities. Mm-hmm. They were almost like competing with each other to see who could be the most philanthropic. But when you tax people very heavily, and it's a double whammy again, because on the one hand, it takes money that they could have used for those kinds of activities, and they don't have it now. And secondly, it says to the world, it says to the society, this is government's job. It's not my job to help somebody in need. I'm walking down the street, like the Good Samaritan story that Jesus told. I'm walking down the street, I see a guy bleeding. It's not my job to go help him. Why? Because that's the government's job, and I pay taxes, so I'm not going to bother. And I really do think that's an understated, unintended consequence. It becomes this bureaucratic, faceless, loveless thing. You know, it's just a policy. No, that's a human being, and you're a human being, and you can help them. But we're discouraged from that because, it's the state's job.
In fact, in many states, it's not just that people are being indirectly discouraged or emotionally discouraged. People are often being legally discouraged. We hear stories from New York, from Las Vegas, where people who were donating food to the homeless, whether it's casinos in Vegas or you know, the Jewish synagogue grandmothers baking bagels in New York, the government's come in and said, you can't do that anymore. You can't give food to the homeless unless it meets our criteria, which is really designed to serve our own interests, our own cronies' interests.
Yeah, I mean, this is very commonly the case with government programs. And, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to knock everybody that works for the government. I mean, there are good people and kind-hearted people and intelligent people, and they just happen to work for the state because, I mean, the state provides, whether we like it or not, the state provides for certain functions in our society as it exists now. But on the other hand, there is a culture and there is a sort of an entanglement. Good people in government are frustrated as well because of the way that the bureaucratic rules and the way it works. It becomes a political spoils contest. You know, you have to be part of the right party or the right crowd or the right group or the party that has the best access to the best Congress that money can buy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what the end result of a policy, it's so mangled beyond what any kind of good intention that it began with, and it functions poorly. I mean, this is what ultimately killed the Soviet Union. You know, they had such great plans. They were going to plan the whole economy, and they were going to be so humane about it. And it was just nothing but a total train wreck, and the wheels fell off within 70 years.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of these things right after this break. Right now we're talking to Larry Bean. He's from Louisiana. He's been active over there, both in spreading the ideas of liberty and some of the benefits of libertarian ideas and policies. Now, if you want to get involved in your state, if you want to make some of these changes happen at the political level, at the legal level, if you want to take some of the power out of the hands of government and allow it to be part of people's individual lives, allow some of these behaviors that have been part of all of human history, charitable behaviors, behaviors based on love and respect, if you want those to be part of American culture once again, well, then you need to do something about it. And to me, that first step is going to lp.org/states and see how to get involved with the Libertarian Party in your state. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. We'll be right back.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Ready to chat about your favorite soap operas? The Daytime Discussion is here with Dan J. Kroll and Soap Central Live. For the past 15 years, Dan has been dishing and discussing on SoapCentral.com. And now he's taking the talk to the airwaves of the Voice America Variety Channel. You'll go behind the scenes with the biggest stars of daytime, along with guest commentary from the Soap Central columnists. And we'll take your questions and comments during our live show. Soap Central Live, every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
No matter what your current situation is, you have a unique story to your life. It's a dynamically changing story that requires constant adjustments to lifestyle and environment. That includes your home. As you continue to enhance your living space, you are also making overall improvements to increase the value of your home. Join Laura Minniff each Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time for dynamic insights for your home environment on the Voice America Variety Channel. And start living now.
stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvin Vora.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvin Vora. Poverty is a real issue in America. It's a real issue across the world. And the solutions so far have been ineffective. And that's mostly because they've been government solutions that have had the opposite of the intended consequences. Now, right now, libertarians, like my guest right now, libertarians across the country, are working to change that. They're working to find solutions that will actually work, not just pretend to work, but will actually make things better. Larry, what would you say is the most important thing right now in terms of changing how we approach poverty?
Well, you know, I think we have to have a change in our mind about what poverty is and what causes it. I mean, there's this kind of oversimplification of the problem. You know, it's sort of like if you're a kid and you're 3 years old and you see Johnny has five pieces of candy and you only have one. I mean, the first thing that pops into your mind, that's not fair, right? And yeah. Johnny should have to give me some of his candy. And, you know, I think that we have this sense that, you know, I think most people really do feel compassion for other people. Who wants to see poor people? Who wants to see someone suffering or hungry or hurting, right? Mm-hmm. So the immediate thing is, well, let's grab something from somebody else and give it to them, and that'll fix the problem. When, in fact, that exacerbates the problem. I mean, it might help the person right now in the next few minutes, but it doesn't solve the problem in the long term. I think we need a new way of looking at things. I think that, you know, I think we need, people need to learn about economics. How, you know, why, where does poverty come from? How does money flow through an economy? The very basics of economics. And once you're exposed to these ideas, then that sort of simple, you know, slash and grab, you know, grab from the rich, and, you know, that's not the first solution we try anymore. Then you might think more in terms of a liberty-based solution. You know, again, let's have North Korea instead of South Korea. You know, another example, a historic example is Hong Kong. After World War II, this was an impoverished place. And so businesses ran in there to take advantage of the cheap labor, and they opened up sweatshops in Hong Kong, and people were working for, you know, terribly low wages. But it didn't last, because that's not the way economics works. As the, as entrepreneurs came in, as businesses came in to capitalize on the cheap labor, it lifted everybody's, you know, as President Kennedy said, a rising tide lifts all ships. And within a generation, Hong Kong was among the wealthiest countries in the whole world. And it's today right up there in like the top two or three places in the world in terms of wealth. Wealth is created. It's not just redistributed here and there. And again, I think we need to just kind of rethink poverty in terms of, you know, what is the root cause of it. And as often as not, government intervention is a cause of poverty rather than a solution. So the more things we can privatize, the lower taxes and regulations will be, the less involved that the state is involved in our lives, we will see the rates of poverty decrease.
Now, one of the things that people are talking about right now is that because, you know, young men and women have such a difficult time getting jobs unless they have a college degree, that more and more are just going to get a degree, getting a huge pile of debt, and all this kind of stuff. Do you think that if some of these government restrictions were lifted, that type of you must do this thing, you must take on all this debt situation that's putting, you know, just all kinds of people essentially into poverty, do you think that that's something that can be reversed?
Yeah, I think it would be reversed fairly quickly. I mean, you know, prosperity, once prosperity starts to come, it spreads very quickly. You know, like think about, for instance, if you're a young person and maybe you don't have money to attend a four-year university, or maybe you just don't want to do something that requires a four-year degree. Let's say you want to cut hair. Mm-hmm. That is a great profession. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world if you're a barber or a hairdresser, and you can make a living. And if you're good at it, you can make a lot of money at it. And it's a skill that you can get better at.
Yep.
So it used to be you could apprentice yourself. I understand, like in Louisiana, you can still do it, but it's still very heavily regulated by the state. But in a mm-hmm. lot of places, you simply can't do that anymore. You have to attend a state-regulated, state-accredited school, and these schools are not cheap. And it creates a barrier. But, you know, in a free market, you know, a young person can go hang out at the barbershop, learn how to do it, maybe take some customers, maybe work a little bit, maybe spend a year learning the craft, and, you know, who knows, if they do a good job, why should they have to get a license? Why should they have to jump through all of these hoops? If they're good at cutting hair and people are willing to pay them to do it, you know, what's the whole point? I mean, the point of the licensing in that profession and in other professions is really to keep people out, to keep the competition down, to keep the price high. That's mm-hmm. really what is driving that. But, you know, and it's hard for people to kind of see that right away. They got to kind of understand what's the purpose of the license. They think that license on the wall means I'm going to get a good haircut. I mean, maybe not. But it really, what it is, it's a barrier to entry into a market. It's a hurdle for somebody to go from poverty to having a skill. And those are the kinds of barriers we need to smash. Those barriers we need a society where people can go. If somebody shows some initiative and they want to learn something, they shouldn't have to jump through all kinds of state hoops in order to do it.
It's interesting that you bring up the, you know, that classic example of hairdressers. It's interesting because more and more people are pointing out that this is not just a thing that affects, you know, unskilled, semi-skilled labor. It also affects the most highly skilled types of labor in the world. If yeah. you're a neurosurgeon right now, and you're graduated from Oxford, and you've been practicing for 40 years, and you are the head of neurosurgery at, you know, some major hospital in London, you're not allowed to practice medicine in America. I mean, that's it's not just that we're keeping out. We're keeping out. It's like we're holding down just everyone with this, and that means all of us, rich or poor or otherwise, are now paying much more than we would otherwise for things that are, you know, relatively inexpensive, like a haircut, or a lot more for things that are extremely expensive, like surgery.
Well, you know, it's a good point because, you know, the economy isn't, it's not in a vacuum, so it's all interconnected. You know, like when the Soviet Union fell and people from Eastern Europe were free to emigrate. I know we had situations where we had immigrants coming to the United States. People were driving cabs and waiting tables, but, you know, back in their home country, they were neurosurgeons, they were physicists. But because of the licensing requirements and so forth, it creates all these hurdles for them to ply their trade in the United States. You might have a world class neurosurgeon waiting tables because that's the only work he can get. And, you know, think about how that ripples through the economy. That means the neurosurgeon he's taking a job that a young person, an entry-level person, could have had but won't now. And furthermore, he could have a neurosurgery clinic that employs 100 people, but he doesn't mm-hmm. now. All because the state has some kind of bureaucratic restriction on it, you know. And again, you don't see what never happened. You know, you don't see the opportunity cost of a particular policy because it's something that never happened. And it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around that.
It's just such a backwards approach. One of the downsides of what's happening right now in terms of this overregulation is that we're seeing what already has happened in manufacturing, which is all the jobs being exported to other countries, now starting to spread to more and more parts of the service sector. Certainly in my sector, education, you know, more and more countries just realizing that you can do something better from overseas because you don't have to deal with government nonsense. A big part of that, I think, will actually, if by reversing that, we're going to actually bring jobs back to America if we can just get rid of some of these ridiculous hurdles.
You know, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, we saw this situation in North Dakota. The state of North Dakota had they eliminated their, I believe it was their corporate income tax, and all of a sudden corporations started going there, and it drove the labor costs crazy. And you know, if we had people like just migrating there, it was like a gold rush kind of situation a couple years ago. Or, you know, people go to Texas, for instance, because they have low taxes. And when you see that kind of prosperity, well, yeah, okay, so you're a poor person. Maybe you're starting off at a, you know, at a very low level job, but you're not going to stay there very long. If you're surrounded by prosperity and there, you know, you encounter other opportunities for developing your skills and moving up, that's really the solution to poverty, not coming up with a government plan to let's take money from Joe and give it to Bill. I mean, that's just that's not sustainable in the long term. There has to be economic growth and jobs, and the regulations get in the way of that.
Absolutely. All right, Father Larry Bean, thank you so much for being on the show today and for sharing your insights both in the economic and the human aspects of how libertarian policies can actually lift people out of poverty.
Well, thank you, Arvin. This has been a great privilege and a lot of fun.
Guys, we were just talking with Father Larry Bean. He is a major activist in Louisiana, spreading both the ideas of liberty and the benefits of libertarian policies. But here's the thing. He's not going to be able to do it by himself. I'm not going to be able to make all these changes by myself. We all need your help. We need you to get involved. Go to lp.org/states. Go to a meeting at your local libertarian chapter. If you're in a really big state, it'll probably be in your county. If you're in a very small state, it'll probably be statewide. You're going to meet great people. You're going to meet other people with the same goals as you. They want to cut government to advance personal freedom. But they all can use as much help as they can. You might decide to volunteer on social media or volunteer at fairs. You might decide, in fact, you might even decide to run for office as a libertarian. But that first step is just going to lp.org/states and seeing how you can get involved in a libertarian, in the Libertarian Party in your state. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvin Vora. We'll be right back.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
If you hear a dog barking or an angel singing, then you know that you are listening to Waking Up in America. Heard every Wednesday at 3 Pacific Time, Valerie Kirkhard and all of her friends will bring you powerful and humorous discussions that raise thoughts and give you insight on how to live your life to its fullest potential. Adventure is always a must on Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkhard, every Wednesday at 3 Pacific.
In the spirit of Have Couch, Will Travel, Dr. Carol Lieberman creates a haven of sanity in an increasingly insane world. Each day we are bombarded with news of events that have never crossed our wildest nightmares. Society is spiraling out of control and everyone is reeling from it. But now there's an answer. The best way to keep sane in this insane world is to tune in to Dr. Carol's Couch on Voice America. Dr. Carol, a certified media psychiatrist, will broadcast live from her Beverly Hills office every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Call or log in and get help with whatever is sending you reeling whenever you need a soothing voice to calm and advise you. That's Dr. Carol's Couch every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on America's Voice, voiceamerica.com.
Are you a business innovator or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
This
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvin Vora.
Welcome to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvin Vora. Now, in the last several weeks, the Republican Party has made it very clear that they are all about fighting against immigration. Immigration is destroying the country. Immigrants are simultaneously doing nothing all day but also stealing our jobs. Immigration somehow, according to the Republican Party, is this huge, massive negative problem. But the issue is, most economists disagree. Most people are trying to figure out what's going on with the Republican Party. Are they wrong, or are all the economists that have said actually immigration benefits us, are they wrong? With me right now is Andy Craig. He's running for the U.S. House District 4 in Wisconsin. His website, Andy, your website is andycraig.com, right?
No, I do not have that. You can reach me through at democracy.com/AndyCraig2016.
Oh, okay. democracy.com/AndyCraig2016. Andy, welcome to the show. Now, tell me, how does immigration benefit people who are not themselves immigrating?
Well, anybody who's, not to get too stereotypical with our examples, but anybody who's gone into a grocery store and has paid less than $5 for a tomato or $8 for an apple has benefited from immigration.
And hey, explain, you know, like I think I know where you're going with this, but explain, what do you mean by that?
Well, as anybody who works in the agricultural sector will tell you, it doesn't get done without immigrants. The reality is, if we did not have migrant laborers willing to provide this low-cost manual labor, and I wouldn't even call it low-skilled because it's not a low-skilled thing to do by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a low-cost labor source, and without that, these are not jobs that would somehow go to Americans. These are jobs that would be shipped overseas. They can grow fruit overseas too. if you're talking about seriously deporting 20 million people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson and the rest of them are going on about, you're going to wipe out entire industries in the United States. And one of the hardest hit will be agriculture.
And what that means, I mean, to really put that in perspective, what that means is, if you are employed in any aspect of the agricultural industry, if you work for a company that makes tools used in agriculture, those tools are not going to be sold in America. If you do anything that's involved in agriculture, it's not like you have to be a farmer. You could work for 3M, and in some aspect of 3M that works with agricultural tools, and whatever part of that was being sold in America is no longer going to be sold in America because it would be, as you correctly pointed out, exported, just like the huge bulk of the manufacturing sector has already been exported. This is not something that's never happened in human history.
And I will say, you know, you talk about manufacturing jobs being exported here in Wisconsin and Milwaukee. Obviously, that's a big topic, and the decline of industrial mass production hit us hard. But there is still, it is still big industry here, and what we do is we make big, heavy equipment that requires high-skilled labor and a lot of capital investment to make is still built here in Wisconsin and shipped all over the world. GE engines and Caterpillar bulldozers and all that sort of thing, and contrary to what my opponent says, the Export-Import Bank has very little to do with that.
Now, let's talk about some of the ways that immigration creates jobs, and then I actually do want to talk about the Export-Import Bank after that,
sure.
if you have time. But let's talk about how does immigration create? Now, let's say your parents, you know, either came here on the Mayflower or they came here on, you know, whatever boat that the original Native Americans came over from Siberia, wherever. They've been here for centuries. How are you benefited? How do your job prospects improve through immigration?
Well, there is a great video explaining this on the Learn Liberty YouTube channel. It's called Three Immigration Myths Debunked or something like this. But he has this great visual where he explains in economic terms that immigrant labor tends to be either very low-skilled or very high-skilled, and most American labor is in the middle. So mm-hmm. there is much more of a complementary effect than there is competing for the same jobs even. So, and in a direct way, it, you know, just general economic growth. We would not see, you know, nobody's too pleased with GDP limping along at 1% or 2% growth. We'd be in negative territory quite easily. Something like 1 in 5 small businesses in the country is owned and was started by an immigrant. Mm-hmm. So you know, I was talking about agriculture, but like I said, that's kind of a stereotypical example. It's much broader than that.
Now, all these small businesses that you're talking about, I mean, that's really a major part of job growth. I mean, a huge percentage of new jobs come from small businesses because it's likely that any individual small business could become 5 times the size it is right now. You know, somebody starts a business, they're one person, they hire 4 people, it's 5 times big. That happens all the time. It's just not as likely for a giant company to suddenly become 4 times as big as it was before. With those right. those jobs that are being created by immigration, what are the things that we can do right now to encourage more of that job growth?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing we can do, and you want to talk about a benefit to existing American taxpayers, people you know, like me, whose ancestors have been here since the Declaration or however far back you want to trace it, is the cost. Right now, if you look at the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals, every other federal criminal law enforcement agency combined, and all the horrible things they do that libertarians talk about, the U.S. government spends less on those than it does on Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. $18 billion a year in order to stop people from hiring or renting to or voluntarily interacting with people who don't have their government permission slip. That is a huge drain just on the public taxpayer. And if you talk about ramping it up like they're doing, you're looking at orders of magnitude. You're talking about spending, you know, as much money almost as we used to wage World War II in order to ramp up immigration enforcement to that kind of level. And even if your concern is not the well-being of immigrants and foreigners, that is a direct aggression against Americans. People right here who were born in America who are getting sent to jail or fined because, like I said, they either hired or rented to or otherwise voluntarily interacted with somebody that doesn't have their government permission slip.
And there's that two-sided thing. One, you're telling an American whose parents have been, whose great 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 grandparents came here, that he or she is not free to hire or sell to whoever he wants, and that's ridiculous. And then the second part that we're saying, in order to enforce this preposterous restriction on you, the person whose great great grandparents came here on the Mayflower, in order to enforce this on you, we're going to charge you more money so that we can interfere with your rights as an American citizen. That's what we're doing right now. But libertarians want to do things a little differently. What do libertarians want to do about immigration?
Well, I mean, I would say that, like our platform says, there is room for reasonable thing. You know, if somebody's wanted murderer or war criminal, or maybe if they have some contagious disease, there are certain discrete categories where we can have some, you know, limitations on that. But simply restricting the number of people who can come into the country for no other reason than restricting their number is wasteful and destructive and doesn't do us any good at all. This is, you know, it's become a cliche, but it's a cliche because as it's so true that this country was built on immigrants. And here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, that that's a stronger heritage that people remember. You know, this is a place where German language and Swedish and Norwegian was still spoken in the streets well into the 20th century. It is, in a sense, profoundly un-American, this this know-nothing, anti-immigrant hysteria that the Republican Party has descended into. And, of course, the Democrats offer nothing but, you know, watered-down half measures. Well, we're not going to be quite that crazy about it. You have not seen them push any real solution on this either.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Export-Import Bank. Can you stay after this break?
Sure.
Awesome. Let's do that then. Right now, we're talking with Andy Craig. He's a Libertarian for Congress. He's running for the 4th District in Wisconsin. That's the Milwaukee District. Andy, the election's next Tuesday, right?
No. This is a 2016 election.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So we're talking about he's running for the 2016 election. You've already seen, if you're on Facebook, we're just watching what's going on, and you've already seen all the great stuff that the Andy Craig campaign has put out. And, you know, I often see that, and I share that around. So if you're on Facebook, definitely do that. You can learn more about his campaign at democracy.com/AndyCraig2016. Now, here's the thing. Andy Craig is not running for dictator. Even if he wins, he's not going to be able to do this all by himself. He needs your help. Now, victory for Andy Craig is going to send a very powerful message. But a lot more victories and a lot more support is going to put the old parties on notice. It's going to let them know that they can no longer get away with this, that we're coming for them. We're coming to cut government. We're coming to take away their special privileges. We're coming to stop them from interfering with people's economic and personal freedom. If you're ready to send that message, if you're ready to make them afraid, then go to lp.org/states. Every single person that registers as a libertarian or joins the local state party or even better, runs for office, makes the old parties nervous. And that's what we all need to do. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vora. We'll be right back.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in your brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
The schizophrenia community faces tough challenges every day. The community includes individuals living with schizophrenia, their partners, parents, children, siblings, friends, neighbors, co-workers, and also their providers of health care and social services. To hear Dr. Gordon Atherley introduce members of the schizophrenia community who are sharing their experiences, tune in to Schizophrenia Community Radio every week. Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
Stock prices plunging, home prices receding, and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvind Vora.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vora. With me right now is Andy Craig. He's running for the U.S. House in the 4th District in Wisconsin. That's the Milwaukee District. Andy, what is this? First of all, for the audience that doesn't know, what is the Export-Import Bank?
Well, the Export-Import Bank is widely and correctly known as Boeing's Bank. Its stated purpose is to provide financing for American imports and exports that they somehow couldn't get it, on the private market. In practice, what it is a huge subsidy to a handful of very large corporations. Of course, they give out a token amount to small businesses to provide them cover for that. But the vast majority of what they provide goes to companies like Boeing, and they get by far the biggest chunk. Something like 40-something percent of it goes to Boeing. And their authorization for it expired. This has been a target of libertarians and fiscal conservatives. A lot of people have seen it as the low-hanging fruit of corporate welfare and cronyism and wasteful spending. And so it did. It did expire. A small group in the House was able to keep it out of the budget negotiations that are going on, and so it expired a few months ago. And my incumbent opponent, assuming she's running for re-election, which she probably will, is Gwen Moore, Democrat, is the ranking member on the Trade and Monetary Policy Subcommittee, the subcommittee this falls under. And she has been the one, together with some of the Chamber of Commerce, big business Republicans, have led the effort for a discharge petition, which is a really rarely used effort in the House, where basically you get 218, a majority of members of the House, to say we want to vote on and pass this thing. And so it has to be voted on, even if the Speaker and the leadership don't put it on the schedule and call for a vote. And so that's what the House was finally able to rebel against the Speaker on behalf of, was supposed progressives like Gwen Moore defending corporate special interest and the supposed party of free markets and fiscal responsibility was rallying to defend big government picking winners and losers.
Now, what happens if libertarians, if we get our way and we get rid of the Export-Import Bank for good? What does that mean for American citizens?
Well, very little. There's the direct cost to taxpayers, which is not insignificant. But in terms of the American, like I talked about earlier, businesses here in Wisconsin, we only see something, like I said, we have a big, heavy heavy equipment export industry here. We only see 2% of export-import subsidies. Washington State, where Boeing is headquarters, gets almost half of XM subsidies. So only 2% of total American exports and imports are financed by the XM Bank. It is a drop in the bucket if you're talking about the total economy. All it is a classic textbook case of dispersed costs and concentrated benefits. It doesn't cost most of us that much, but when you add all of it together and then Boeing goes to their congressman and gets it to give it to Boeing, it amounts to over $8 billion a year.
Exactly. And so if we get rid of it, we're not going to see any negative consequences. We're going to see a slight positive consequence, but I think one of the big consequences is actually almost a psychological one, which is it does two things. One, it lets big companies know that if you want to make money, do it the normal way. Don't go around begging for somebody else to give you an even bigger unfair advantage or an even bigger advantage than the one you already have by being a big established company. Just make good products and services and sell them like any normal human being does. Don't get all strange about it.
Right.
So one, it sends that message. But the other thing is when we get rid of it, and I think that we're going to get rid of it one way or the other. If not this time, we'll get rid of it soon. When we get rid of it, then, and the sky doesn't fall, People say, all right, well, we could get rid of that thing. Let's try to get rid of something else. What's the next thing? What's the next thing we could get rid of? If someone was going to ask you, for that matter, what the next thing that you would get rid of, what are you going to put on that list?
In terms of corporate welfare, I think the next thing on my list would be on the military procurement side that Eisenhower so famously warned about, and in particular the F-35, which is just an obscene boondoggle that they are wasting absurd amounts of money on. Way more money that's being wasted on the Export-Import Bank is going into this junk fighter that the services don't want, that the Army's throwing a fit about because it does a worse job than the existing cheaper planes they have. Mm-hmm. And the only reason it's become the military procurement version of too big to fail. They've wasted so much money on it and shoveled so much money after it that, well, we have to keep throwing good money after bad. And that would be pretty up on my list. The chopping block would be the F-35. You know, Milwaukee's share of the F-35 B fleet, which is one of the three variants they're building, will be about one plane. And the taxpayers in Milwaukee will pay more for that one plane than we're paying for the new Milwaukee Bucks Arena.
And that, to me, is just unbelievable. I mean, there's so much of this that it's just resistance. I mean, there's so many things that the president can get rid of by himself. There's so many things that Congress can get rid of by itself. And yet, both sides are just sitting there trying to find ways to make sure that we don't cut anything. Because I do strongly believe that once we cut anything at all, we're going to start cutting a lot more once people see that there's no downside. And even if the upside is tiny, it's still better than nothing.
That's the compromise they just came to, where Obama said, I won't give you your military spending increase unless you give me my domestic spending increase. And that's the, you know, just like Clinton and Newt Gingrich and just like Reagan and Tip O'Neill did, they always compromise to both spend more on what they want to spend on.
Mm-hmm. And really, there's no organization besides Libertarian Party. I mean, I don't think there's any candidate in your race besides you that's serious about cutting any amount of government, let alone a lot of government.
No. I mean, I'm not even sure yet if there will be a Republican running, and if they do, they lose by 50-point blowouts in this district. So doesn't matter much if there's a Republican running or not.
And I think that right there is an extremely important point. One, literally in your district, whether Republican runs or not, they don't have the popularity there, so it's going to be a non-issue. But honestly, whether you look, whichever district you're looking in, even if it's both a Republican and a Democrat, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to spend more money. They're going to infiltrate more into our private lives and our economic lives. But by getting rid of them, by voting against them, we can send them a clear message that A, that's no longer okay, and B, we can take back Congress, we can take back state houses, we can take back school boards and start turning some of this stuff around. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today and talk about immigration and talk about getting rid of things like the Export-Import Bank and getting rid of things like the F-35.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back on.
Guys, we just finished talking with Andy Craig. He's running for the 4th district for the U.S. House of Representatives from Wisconsin. That's the Milwaukee district. If you want to learn more about his campaign, go to democracy.com/AndyCraig2016. You can also follow him on Facebook. I already do follow him on Facebook, and I get a lot of great information both from the Andy Craig campaign and other great articles and things like that from around the entire libertarian blogosphere, if you will. Now, Andy is doing a lot of work. I mean, his campaign is running early. They're putting out great press releases. They've put out great infographics. They've put out all kinds of things. They've done great work in Wisconsin. But here's the thing. Andy's not going to be able to do this all by himself. He needs you, and I need you, and the entire Libertarian Party needs you to get involved and to find ways that you can work to cut government. The first step of that is you need to go to lp.org/states and see how to get involved in a Libertarian campaign in your state. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Arvin Vora, signing off until next week on Libertarians Working for You.
Thank you for tuning in to Libertarians Working for You. Please join Arvin Vora again next Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We hope you have a great week.